From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Sorry about that. I hit the wrong button. I had the show ending before it starts. Nevertheless, tonight, more coverage on the Drew Peterson case. Both sides have rested. The rebuttal has finished. Closing arguments are Tuesday, and we're going to go to one of the experts out there, Robin Sachs, former assistant district attorney. She's an author, an attorney, a legal analyst at Fox 11 LA, and a big friend of the program. Hi, Robin.
Hi there.
Nice to have you.
So nice to be here. I can't believe the timing of planning to be on your show and actually being on your show the day that they rested.
Gee, it's almost like I planned it.
Right, and we didn't.
We didn't, that's for sure. But let's forget about Drew Peterson and all this exciting stuff for just a second and talk about MTV canceling the Jersey Shore. How are we going to be able to survive without classic TV like that?
You know, I got to tell you, I'm losing sleep over it. I have to say, I've made a career out of talking about other people and other people's lives, and Jersey Shore is just a show that hasn't contributed to my career or personal life in any way.
Oh, it hasn't. Okay. So in no time soon will we see Robin interviewing Snooki on Fox 11?
No, although she was at Fox 11. It just wasn't Robin who was doing it.
It was
Robin rolling her eyes.
All right. Okay, enough of that nonsense. Drew Peterson, both sides are done. Arguments Tuesday. Your thoughts?
Well, you know, this case depresses me, frankly. It's a case where I'm highly disappointed in the way that the prosecution handled this case. And it kills me to say it because as I sit here today, I believe wholeheartedly Drew Peterson is good for it. And not only do I think he's good for the murder of Kathleen Savio, but I do think that he's also responsible for the disappearance of Stacey Peterson as well. But having said that, I've watched this case, and it's a hard case, and I'm not beating the prosecution up for that. But what I am beating them up for is the daily reprimand that they've had from the judge. I mean, the daily errors that have come up. I mean, even if there is a conviction in this case, which I just can't see it happening. I mean, you can't have all the evidence of motive, which is not needed for a crime, and no evidence of how it was done, and then toss in there for good measure, you know, appellate issue after appellate issue. It is riddled with problems on appeal, and I would be frankly worried that any conviction would stick anyway.
Robin Sachs here. She's legal analyst with Fox 11 LA. Brodsky decision to bring on what was his name here? Anyway, bring on the testimony that had all of a sudden brought Stacey Peterson into the issue. The divorce lawyer. His name is escaping
me. Yes, that's right.
Some columnist.
The divorce lawyer who she calls and says, you know, would Kathleen get more money or whatever? Or would she get more money if she knew about the death or whatever? The one that Stacey consulted.
Yeah. Smith, I think, is his name. And some of the pundits are saying that that is a big mistake, that Joel Brodsky is just jumped off the cliff with Drew Peterson in his arms. Was it that big of a mistake?
For the prosecution to bring that witness?
No.
For the defense to bring the witness.
For the defense.
I think that it was a big mistake. I think it definitely was a big mistake because, you know, to the prosecution's credit, they kept this case. The more they kept Stacey out of this case, the better it was. This is a case of Kathleen Savio's death and Kathleen Savio's murder. So I thought, you know, to the extent that they can keep it clean in that way, it was only going to help everybody, both the defense and the prosecution, because once you start having all these unknown theories and unknown conclusions, and certainly you don't have a case where the prosecution has filed murder charges or anything relating to Stacey Peterson, it's not going to help the prosecution's case. But as you said, once you start bringing in the Stacey Peterson card, then all that information is out there, and it's only stuff that can, you know, blur the minds of the jurors. But while I think it was a mistake, and I, you know, thanks to you, I was able to have an interview with Joel Brodsky on Fox 11 LA, and I asked him this question. This was, why are you bringing any defense at all? Why do you need to even call a single witness? I don't know why he did. I think that the prosecution's case was problematic on so many levels. They first of all had, you know, not one theory yet of how she actually drowned in the bathtub. There were so many pieces of information that were, you know, just kind of throw up against the wall and see what sticks. As a matter of fact, I think even they said that in their directed verdict motion, you know, see if the jello sticks on the tree, they said. Yep. And I think there was a lot of that. And so if I was the defense, and to their credit, they only put on a few days' worth of testimony, so they didn't make it drag on forever. But really, I would be kicking back with my feet on top of the table and saying, you know what, there's no upside to anybody.
Robin Sachs is here, the divorce attorney Harry Smith. Anyway, what do you think, and some have mentioned, is that something that maybe Drew Peterson wanted? And you as an attorney, how much say does the, or how much weight, I should say, does the attorney listen to his client if they say, why don't you call so-and-so?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I always thought that Drew Peterson was running this ship. I mean, mm-hmm. very, very typical, particularly narcissistic, smart, calculated type defendants. And no doubt he's someone who knows law enforcement. He was a member of law enforcement. He's sat in a number of trials as a cop, so he knows how it goes. So his opinion is going to be, say, valued more than the average Joe defendant who doesn't necessarily have that professional background and experience. And there's certain things in the law that are client decisions, and there's certain things that are attorney decisions. For example, whether you testify or not is ultimately a client decision. Whether you bring a certain motion or not is an attorney decision. And the clue that makes me...
We might have lost Robin. Robin?
No, I just hit you on my mute. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
I think one of the clues that we saw that Drew Peterson was... the marionette behind the scenes here, more than, say, your average defendant, was when he was the one who made the decision to withdraw the motion for a mistrial.
Yep.
For the statements or what have you that happened, you know, in mistrial motion number 2 or 3, he wanted to continue on. That kind of decision would be a lawyer decision by law, and it was because of his choice, or at least that's what his attorney said in court, as to why they did not continue. So. Now, in pre-trial time, as you know, as in the last 4 years, as you know, most of the decisions Drew Peterson made regarding how to handle his own defense seemed pretty lousy. He was a complete jerk on every show he ever went on, any camera that was ever in his face. He seemed like an egotistical, pompous idiot. And so I thought there was no way that we were, you know, his lawyers would be able to exercise any sort of attorney, you know, or client control and get him to keep his mouth quiet, and they seemed to do it. So whatever they were doing, I think they did a good job.
Robin Sachs is here. How about the Michael Bodden aspect of this? Michael Bodden is called on rebuttal. The whole question as to whether or not Fox News was behind the autopsy by him and God, even through Girls Gone Wild into the mix. It was it really a moot point when it all came out?
Yeah, I don't think that. I mean, listen, Michael Bodden's also, first of all, a sexy celebrity witness, if you will, so that does give some cachet to the case. So I think that was part of their strategy in putting him on the stand.
Yep.
That there's a name there, and let's find a reason to bring him on there. And if he's on our team, then by association, it's got to be good. And hey, he normally testifies for the defense. So those kinds of things, I think, were the reason much more than what he was actually saying.
When you look at the case, and I ask you this every time there's a high-profile case about the jury, and we'll get into that in a second, but what about the judge? How do you think it was handled?
Well, I thought the judge was made some great comments and made some very independent rulings. I mean, he didn't hold himself bound by the rulings of the prior judge in terms of hearsay. He looked at each statement individually. and he made his own good rulings. He certainly admonished the prosecution day in and day out. But every time it came to actually doing something about it, I kind of wondered where the, you know, where the teeth were in everything that he was saying. Like, I'm really mad at you, prosecution. You're really stretching. This is really thin. You don't even have a theory for how he was killed. Okay, motion to dismiss denied. So, I mean, it was a lot of smoke blowing in some ways. I mean, at some point, I mean, I understand, listen, there's certain cases and causes that are jury decisions and certain things that are judge decisions. And, you know, look at Trayvon Martin by comparison. I mean, here you've had a judge today that was removed, an appellate court decided to remove him. You had a judge who actually went there on a limb and commented on credibility and pulled someone back. But at least these are judges that are making decisions instead of just kind of hoping everything will work out. And that's why I worry about the appeal issues.
Lots of talk about the jury wearing same colored clothing, blah, 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 all that sort of stuff. Does that mean anything? Can you read into that?
Yeah, that is bizarre. The sports jersey day, when I read a tweet about that, I thought it was a joke. Are you kidding me? I mean, that's worrisome to me. Like, I mean, it's worrisome in one way. I mean, I guess it's good in another way. The good news is that they're going to have, they will have a verdict, it seems, and it won't be a mistrial because there's so much in unity there that they're going to, it seems that they've, you know, established a leader and they've established a system by way to make decisions, and they certainly are a cohesive group, you know, and that's just unusual to see that level of bonding this early in, you know, in the case, you know, even though it's not early in the case in terms of the trial part, but you haven't even gone into the harder part of negotiations, but you have all this personal connection to each other. But I think from both sides, I mean, that this is where I would be nervous if I was Joel Brodsky, and frankly, the prosecution, too. It's like, you know, a win for the defense is a mistrial as well, you know, if it's not a conviction. From the prosecution point of view, they may consider a mistrial a win also as opposed to a complete acquittal if they'd likely go after him again. But the one thing we may see based on the camaraderie here is a result one way or another, so maybe we'll at least have closure one way or another.
Just to explain a little bit, if I could touch on the mistrial part of that, and you did explain a little bit, but go into a little bit deeper. If there is a mistrial, what does that mean for the uneducated?
The mistrial, there's different kinds of mistrials that you can have. I mean, there's mistrials with prejudice, and there's mistrials without prejudice, and depending on where the judge was ruling. So, for example, if it was deemed that the prosecution asked questions that they weren't supposed to ask despite a ruling and did so anyway, like, for example, when that lieutenant was testifying in SWAT uniform and then the order protection question came up,
right,
that wasn't supposed to be referred to. If it's considered to be an unintentional, harmless type of question, there could be a, listen, this is, we can't unring the bell, this is unfair to the defense, so we're going to grant a mistrial. But that just means that we technically start all over again, meaning we kick all the jurors off, we say goodbye and goodnight, and we start the process all over again with the new jury. That's why I think the judge was so hesitant to grant any mistrial, because of just the time and expense and the investment that everyone had spent getting there, which is part of the reason why I think, frankly, that Drew Peterson didn't want to have a mistrial, because of the time and expense and energy he spent getting there. At this point, he was like, screw it, let's just get this sucker over with. I think we're doing so well anyway, and the prosecution is doing so poorly anyway, we might as well just roll the dice with what we have.
How about the jury? How long do you think they'll be out?
Oh, God, yeah, you're making me, you know, do over and under on this jury who wears the same sports team. You know, it depends what day the case gets to them. You know, more time out if it's Wednesday or Thursday that they start deliberating, less time if it's Friday. It depends if they start in the morning or afternoon. I don't feel like this was a particularly complicated case. They either believe that he was responsible or he wasn't. And I think what they're going to have struggle with is to show, you know, they're going to have trouble is saying, listen, we don't think she killed herself, but we can't say that Drew Peterson did it.
Okay.
And if they can't get, and even, you know, they can, and if somebody has had the feeling of killing somebody before but has never done it, they're going to have a hard time convicting somebody.
That's going to be interesting to see. What are you up to on Fox 11 LA?
You know what, tomorrow night at 10:30 p.m., we are having a special. I do a monthly special, and this one is on bullies. And for anybody who knows Michelle Golan, she is a common pundit over there at CNN, HLN. She's a psychologist. And her son was the victim of bullying. And we cover her story, and we talk about school bullying as we're just here at the beginning of the new school year. And, if you know, it's very fascinating because this is a kid in Los Angeles who is being bullied where the parents are a psychologist and a lawyer. And they navigate through their whole situation, and they keep a video log and a video diary, and they try to do everything right, and they are getting no support from the school, no support from the school district, no support from the bully parents, and talk about their frustration. So that's a big special that we have coming up. And then, of course, I'm following the tennis referee case. I don't know if you've heard about Lois Goodman, the 78-year-old woman or so who is accused of killing her 80-year-old husband with a coffee cup, a coffee mug, bludgeoning him to death. There's all kinds of good stuff here.
Absolutely. And looks like Lindsay Lohan might be having some problems again.
Oh, yeah. I mean, come on. It's not a week in L.A. without La Lindsay causing problems, not paying bills, potentially stealing jewelry. She's the gift that keeps on giving.
There you go. Robin Sachs, attorney at law, legal analyst at Fox 11 L.A. Always a pleasure, my friend. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see when the Peterson jury goes out. How long will they be out before they come back in? Will there be questions? Will this be another Anthony case? Will Drew Peterson go into hiding if he gets off? Will he get convicted? I don't know. We're going to continue on in a little bit and talk more about Drew Peterson with Beth Karras from True TV. And take a quick break, come back with Mike McIntyre, the crime reporter from the Winnipeg Free Press and true crime author and radio show host, and talk about a judge who let her hair down and took her clothes off, and some of those pictures got on the internet. And then we're going to talk about another judge who decided not to listen to the he listened to the prosecution and the defense's submission for sentence, but he didn't go with what they said and ended up sending the guy to jail. So we have a Scared Monkeys Judge of the Month. And continue on, again, like I said, with Beth Karras from True TV, who's actually in the Peterson courtroom to get her take on this. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. I'm Dana Pretzer. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name's Dana Pretzer. You all know Mike McIntyre. He's a reporter for the Winnipeg Free Press, the host of Crime and Punishment on the Chorus and Rocco radio networks, and author of 5 Canadian true crime books. A friend of the program. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Always good to be here, Dana.
Now, I've got some breaking news. It's not crime-related, but I know how big of a fan you are of Snooki and JWoww that MTV has canceled the Jersey Shore. This is going to be its last year, and what are we going to do without that high-quality style of TV, Mike?
I guess that's where Honey Boo Boo.
Yeah, all right.
Isn't that the new? That's kind of the new.
Yes.
The new Snooki, I guess. She's the 6-year-old Snooki. I'm actually, Dana, ashamed to admit that, believe it or not, while my wife and I were in Las Vegas last week, we happened to be flipping channels in our hotel room, and lo and behold, on the screen was this monstrosity of a program called Honey Boo Boo, and we actually watched it for a good 15 or 20 minutes. And if there's ever a program to show that there really is, that everybody can get their 15 minutes of fame somehow, some way, that's the program for it. So I guess Snooki and her crew are kind of yesterday's news, and the new crew is on the way.
Now, I hope we're not going to see any pictures of Mike McIntyre on TMZ, are we?
No. You know, it's funny, though. We were staying right across the street from the MGM. We stayed at the Monte Carlo, but the MGM, of course, is where one young Prince Harry had made headlines 2 days before we went to Vegas. So, and it's funny, just walking the streets, that was sort of all the rage, lots of people talking about it, joking about it. I guess there's some major MGM, and the owner of that hotel is not very happy that these photos leaked out. There's a big investigation underway because they obviously try to cater to celebrities, and the fact these pictures got out, and I've never really heard anyone speculate on who released these photos. I assumed it was somebody from within the prince's camp, but these naughty photos of him playing strip billiards, which, by the way, is the first time I've ever heard of that as a game, has triggered this investigation because it's probably going to potentially hurt the bottom line of this hotel.
Yeah, and there's all sorts of jokes we can use about bottom line and pool balls and stuff. But anyway, we won't go there.
No, we probably should not.
Speaking of leaked out photos, I wanted to bring you on to talk about a judge that we talked about on the show a while back, leaked out photos, the internet, and what's going on with that case?
Well, this case is, they should probably be holding this case in Vegas, Dana, because it is, that's the perfect environment for what's going on. This is a complete gong show, circus, you name it, that is really putting the Canadian judiciary in a unfavorable light. I think in a lot of ways it's making a laughingstock of the bench. In a nutshell, for those maybe not familiar with the story, there's a judge in Manitoba, a family court judge. She doesn't hear criminal cases. She hears family cases, and that might actually be part of the problem because, as I'm sure listeners can appreciate, you actually have to make moral and sort of value-based decisions a lot more in family court than you would in criminal court. You're deciding who gets custody and child protection issues, things like that. So this judge, her name is Lori Douglas. She, for the last 2 years, has been under investigation and, in fact, is stepped down from the bench temporarily while this investigation is underway by the governing body in Canada called the Canadian Judicial Council. They're investigating her for photos of her that go all the way back to 2003, so we're talking almost a decade ago, before she was a judge, photos that show her and her husband, mainly her, though, engaged in bondage and S&M type of sexual situations. These are obviously very graphic, explicit photos. And the big story here and why this has kind of made news up in Canada, besides the fact that this involves a judge, is that her husband, a bit of a sleazeball, if you will, he actually was the one who leaked these photos to one of his clients. Her husband is a lawyer, and he tried to solicit one of his clients to have sex with his wife, arrange a threesome, if you will. All these years ago, the former client is the one who then came forward publicly a couple years ago, claimed that he was sexually harassed by his former lawyer, by the judge, produced these photos, and of course this story has just taken on a life of its own. So you've got this governing body now in Canada that is convened to decide whether this judge, with these nude photos that go back a decade, is fit to remain on the bench. And it's a very salacious, car wreck type of hearing that has come up with its own issues, I guess, in and of itself, Dana, because the independent counsel, the man that was appointed to lead this hearing, which is several weeks into the hearing, just announced this week that he quits. He's taking his ball and going home. And it's clear that there's a clash between him and the Judicial Council over some of the rules that were set out for this hearing. It's clear that he doesn't agree with much of what's happened, and so he's quit. So this Judicial Council hearing is now very much in limbo. It's supposed to reconvene later this year, but now they've got to go find a new independent counsel. And as I say, the whole time the judge's fate hangs in limbo and the Canadian judiciary takes a bit of a beating.
Now, this never happens up here. It's very rare, correct?
This is the eighth hearing in the entire 40-plus year history of this judicial council. So to convene a hearing to decide the fate of a judge is extremely rare. This is obviously the first of these kind of facts, Dana, where a judge's sex life, private sex life, has sort of become public. I mean, beneath the scandalous photos and whatnot, there are some interesting questions that have been raised. For instance, as a family court judge, how deep into the bedrooms of our judges should we be going as a society? Is it any business of ours what kind of sexual lifestyle a judge might be into. There are those who have said that this does play this is a factor, because if she's going to be making these sort of moral and value-based decisions, well, it's important to know where she's coming from in her own experience. But, you know, you get that slippery slope argument, of course, that says, well, if we're going to punish someone because she's into S&M and threesomes with her husband and another man, where do you stop? Do you start to say, well, you know, a judge who's homosexual, is somebody going to suggest now that they're not fit to sit on the bench or hear certain cases because of their sexual preference? So that's kind of the argument that's been advanced, and it's an interesting question. I'm just not sure when or if we're ever going to get an answer to it.
Mike McIntyre is here. We're going to go from one strange case about a judge to a judge who I consider to be the Scared Monkeys Judge of the Year, Judge Ray Wyant, and his recent decision to, as you write, jump the joint. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, this was certainly an interesting decision that got a lot of people's attention a couple of weeks ago. As I'm sure you know, Dana, and a lot of listeners know, there's a real issue with impaired driving. Still to this day, we're inundated with messages not to drink and drive, you know, to use a designated driver, not to get behind the wheel. I don't know that there could be any more messages out there. They're everywhere, with commercials and people, you know, lecturing in schools and whatnot. And yet, it's clear, and the evidence shows that people still don't get that message. For whatever reason, people think that they can get behind the wheel after a few drinks, that they know best and they can handle it. And we've seen the tragic results, the tragic stories that often play out on our streets and highways, especially in more rural areas like where you live, Dana, in Saskatchewan, where I live in Manitoba. We see these impaired driving tragedies far too often. So a few weeks ago, a guy came before Judge Ray Wyant, and he's a first-time offender. It's worth noting that he didn't injure anybody. He certainly didn't kill anybody. He was driving his car drunk, and he ran into a ditch, and he got arrested, and he blew quite high, in fact, over triple the legal limit. That's a very high reading. Extremely intoxicated he would have been. And the judge did something that few judges do. When confronted with a joint recommendation from Crown and defense lawyers, they both said, this is what we think this deserves. And in this case, Dana, they were advocating for not custody, for just a fine, which they said is the standard sentence that's always given out in these types of cases. Right. Judge Wyant went out on a bit of a limb, said, why should I continue to give the kind of sentence that it's clear Canadians are not responding to? The message is not being received. And what he did is he threw this guy in jail. Now, it wasn't a long jail sentence, a couple of weeks, but the message was clear, and a new benchmark, if you will, has now been set. It's worth noting that this sentence was not appealed. That means it stands as a precedence. And the judge actually made the comment that day, the gloves are coming off, that this is far too prevalent of a crime in society, and as judges, we need to start doing something about it. And if that means tougher sentences, if that means sending first-time offenders who don't hurt anybody and who have an otherwise admirable background and track record to jail, then so be it. And to that, I say kudos to the judge. Let's hope other judges follow suit.
Absolutely. Judge Ray Wyant, the hero of this radio program. And that's an interesting topic, too, Mike, when it comes to plea bargaining. And if you go to MikeOnCrime.com, you'll learn more about some of the stories that Mike writes about. Very seldom do accused go to court and get sentenced for what they're initially charged for. It's always dealt down, or in most cases it's dealt down. Let's talk about the difference between the Canadian and U.S. system.
Well, it's interesting because the U.S. system is based more as a state system. I mean, each individual state, right, rather than sort of follow sentencing precedents from across the U.S., you go to an individual state, and I've been down, for instance, in Minnesota several times covering cases, and you sit in a sentencing hearing, and they are basing their sentences on other Minnesota crimes of that nature. they're not looking at, you know, what did a judge in Florida give a guy for a similar offense, or what did a judge in Alabama do in this case? So they're really looking at state law in that case. Here in Canada, we have the federal criminal code, and judges routinely, as do lawyers, bring up precedents from coast to coast. It's not unusual to sit in a Winnipeg courtroom and hear cases from Vancouver and Halifax and Montreal and Toronto, sure, and Calgary. And so when a judge, you know, in one courtroom on one coast does something, it has a ripple effect across the country. And precedence, case law, is a big factor for judges. Judges seem to want to go with the status quo. They don't want to necessarily go out on that limb. One of the big fears is that if you do that, if you kind of step out of line, you're going to get your knuckles wrapped by the appeal court, and no judge wants to be known as the judge who's constantly being overturned. So in the U.S., there seems to be more flexibility. They can address specific concerns, say, in one state, if there's a certain type of crime that is more prevalent. It seems like it's a lot easier to address it and not get so burdened down by other case precedent. The other big difference, of course, Dana, is they elect their judges in the U.S. Yeah. We appoint them here in Canada. And, you know, there's mixed returns on that. A lot of people love the fact judges are elected because they feel they're much more accountable to the public. They've got their finger on the pulse, if you will, in a way that judges in Canada don't. The flip side of that argument, though, is that you also may get judges who are pandering to the public and are maybe going over the line with some of their sentences just to curry favor.
Mike McIntyre is here. Check out his website at mikeoncrime.com. Just before I let you go, I want to get your thoughts on the Drew Peterson trial that's going on. Again, Canada versus the United States, these high-profile cases. The former police sergeant on trial for the murder of his third wife, his fourth wife still missing. The media all over it, like a bird on a bug, yours truly included. What about cases like that? Will we ever see that kind of coverage in Canada?
Well, I mean, I think the closest we came to it was maybe the Russell Williams case, right, last year in Canada, the former military, high-ranking military member accused of killing two innocent women and sexually assaulting others and being sort of a predator. He had the whole double life thing. I mean, that was a case not only here in Canada did it get a lot of play, it really did get picked up internationally. U.S. networks did features on it. Books are being written on it. TV movies are in the works, that sort of thing. So I think, you know, from time to time, you do get that perfect storm, if you will, of sort of a mix of celebrity and salaciousness and intrigue. I suspect, Dana, we may see some of that with the Luca Magnotta case.
Absolutely.
There's a guy who has made headlines around the world because of the horrific nature of the crime he allegedly committed. I mean, when you boil down to it, the crime itself, a man kills another man in what may be more of a domestic type of relationship, that's not all that unusual, but it's everything else about the case, the mailing of the body parts to government and to schools, the videotaping of the crime and posting online, the almost taunting nature of the alleged killer and the fact he's arrested in Germany. That's a case which seems destined to make the kind of headlines and news stories that a case like the Peterson one is. And, you know, I think as a society, I mean, we clearly have a big interest in crime and justice of any kind. But I think when you get a case like this, that the characters almost become larger than life. I mean, look at the O.J. trial, right? And what became of all those lawyers. That brought instant fame to really everybody that was involved in that trial. And, you know, from the prosecutor to the defense to the judge to the witnesses, you name it. And I think in the U.S. there's maybe more of an opportunity for that because of, you know, they have a lot more cable news networks and there's a bigger audience there, of course. But this seems to be what the public appetite is, and there are many out there who want to keep feeding the hungry public.
Absolutely. Mike McIntyre is a justice reporter with the Winnipeg Free Press. He hosts the Crime and Punishment radio show, and I understand he's going to be starting a fan club for Honey Boo Boo sometime soon.
Yeah, we'll get right on that, Dana. I'll let you know about the website and maybe meet and greets and belly flop contests and you name it. We'll get on it.
You bet. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Dana.
Bye bye. That's Mike McIntyre. He's a great author, too, Five Canadian True Crime Books. Check out his webpage at mikeoncrime.com, and he does the Twitter thing, twitter.com/mikeoncrime. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back in our continuing coverage of the Drew Peterson trial. We have Beth Karras. She is a senior correspondent with True TV, a former prosecutor, and a big kick to have her on the show. Welcome, Beth.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Oh, you've been spending some time in court as a former prosecutor. This is secondhand to you. You've covered these stories lots. The sides have rested. The rebuttal is done. The arguments are going ahead on Tuesday, I hear. Your thoughts on where the trial is going to go from here. What do you think?
Well, I got to tell you, Dana, a trial is a living, breathing entity. And one side is up one day and down the next day. And this trial has been no exception. In fact, that pendulum has swung perhaps even more than a lot of trials I have either handled myself or covered over the years.
One day
the state's up and the next day the defense is. And I'll tell you right now, with what the defense did yesterday,
yep,
I think it gave the state a lot of momentum.
I was just about to ask you about Harry Smith. How big of a mistake was that?
Well, the consensus around the courthouse is that it was a mistake, because although they were calling the divorce attorney of Kathleen Savio, who was consulted by the missing Stacey, to try to show that Stacey was not believable and was making it up when she told her pastor that she had information about Drew the night Kathy Savio was killed, and when she told the lawyer, "Can I get more money out of Drew in a divorce if I say how he killed Kathy?"
Mm-hmm.
She was just making it up. But you know what? It was a game changer. At least that's the consensus around the courthouse when the jurors heard that. There were jurors who seemed to be with the defense during the defense experts, like one of the women who seemed to elbow another juror, like, "See, huh, I told you,"
uh-huh,
nodding her head in accordance with what a defense expert is saying, that it's an accident. Those jurors became stone-faced once Harry Smith testified. Now, it doesn't mean the defense can't still pull it off, but many people feel the best the defense will do is get a hung jury, not 12 people voting not guilty. In fact, there might be 12 people voting guilty.
Wow, it's interesting for sure. Beth Karras is here from True TV. The jury itself, with the color-coordinated shirts and all that sort of stuff, can we read anything into that, or is that just camaraderie?
Well, at a minimum, it's camaraderie, right? But it probably indicates that there will be unanimity. Whatever they do, there will be unanimity,
okay,
guilty or not guilty, as opposed to a split verdict. I think they're just having fun, because I'll tell you, that jury was out of the courtroom probably as much as they were in the courtroom over the past 5 weeks, up and down and in and out. It was unbelievable. I don't think I've ever seen anything like that, where jurors were excused so much. It's a small courtroom, and I'm told that they just didn't have the ability to deal with a lot of the sidebar issues at sidebar, because the judge needed to, like, argue it, and the jurors couldn't be sitting there because the courtroom was so small. They would hear what was going on at the bench. So he would send them out all the time, and it was really disruptive, unbelievable. Anyway, the jurors were playing games, you know, deciding, well, let's have some fun.
Okay.
And that's what they decided to do in the last few weeks only.
Casey Anthony, Drew Peterson, the public's perception. I've interviewed Drew Peterson 3 times on this program, and each time I probably had the most listeners ever, but I also had the most hate mail ever. Is this something where Drew Peterson could have been convicted in the court of public opinion before the trial even started?
Well, you know, I think there's no question that most people, at least here in Illinois, most people believe he's guilty. A lot of people know it's a long shot and that he may not be found guilty. With Casey Anthony, she definitely was convicted in the court of public opinion, and the public knew everything about the case.
Right.
Because in Florida, we had the 25,000 pages of discovery. We don't have that here in Illinois. So people were still learning stuff during the course of this case, even though a lot was known about Stacy, and a lot about Stacy's not a part of the trial. So I know that he's kind of the male counterpart of Casey, and they're both in totally circumstantial cases. But I think that there's an expectation that Drew Peterson might be acquitted. Jim Glasgow, the prosecutor, did have courage in exhuming Kathleen Savio's body after it was ruled an accident and saying, you know what, I'm going for it. That was an uphill battle for the prosecution. And it was a difficult, difficult trial. I mean, they got beat up by this team of defense lawyers who objected every which way, and a judge who had been defeated by Jim Glasgow in 1992, and they did, as state's attorney, and they used to work together also. So there was no love lost between those two, you know? So it was a really tough case for the prosecution anyway. So I think that there's an expectation that he may be acquitted, but I don't know that the jury will be blamed for that necessarily, like in Casey Anthony, or the prosecution blamed for it. It is what it is. But there's another case around the corner.
Yeah, exactly.
Prosecutors could be charging him with Stacy's death.
Okay, that's interesting. Why do you say that? Because we're hearing that from half of one side, and we're hearing that's not going to happen from half of the other side. What have you been hearing?
Well, I don't know that it's going to happen, but I have seen cases successfully prosecuted when there is no body.
Right.
And there are many people, defense and prosecution, and general public, who tell me they believe that the case against him regarding Stacy is stronger than Kathleen Savio.
Wow, that's interesting. Beth Karras is here from True TV. Let's get to the defense team a little bit. Lots of criticism, obviously. Defense lawyers normally do. The Joe Tacopinas of the world and the Jose Baezes, et cetera, et cetera. How do you think the defense team handled this? You know, the sunglasses, the press conferences. Joe Brodsky told me early on my program, even before Drew was arrested, that if this happened, he's going to do everything he can in the media with his client. Was that a good move or a bad move?
Well, let me tell you, regarding the sunglasses, it became the look for these guys. But I'm out there for that press conference at the end of the day, every day. And they are facing the sun.
Sure, yeah.
So, I mean, they really are facing the sun. And we're not, right? The press, our backs are to the sun. And we're looking up at them, and they're facing the sun. And I know what it's like being on TV when I'm going to face the sun. I mean, you're squinting. So, and it became kind of their look. And I know they've been, you know, some people think it's kind of cool. Some people are criticizing them for it. But you know what? There are such bigger issues going on here. To me, you know, that stuff just rolls off me. And they're the only ones talking. I mean, they talk in the morning, at lunch, they talk at night. And, you know, we've got to keep them in check. I debate one of them, Steve Greenberg, because, and I've debated the others too, because no one's given the prosecution side. So I just take another side to just keep them in check because, you know, they're telling us their interpretation of the evidence.
Sure.
And that's what that's their job. That's what defense lawyers do. And I don't blame them for it. It's a good team of lawyers, and they've been, you know, united. And they really fought hard for Drew Peterson. It's a tough case for the prosecution. It's theirs to win for the defense.
How about Glasgow? He's criticized lots, admonished by the judge, but it was always interesting. The judge would chew him out, for lack of a better term, but then there was nothing after that. What about the prosecutor or prosecution team? How did they do?
Well, this prosecution team worked very hard. John Connor and Chris Koch. Well, Chris Koch joined the team late, and he's going to be giving the main summation on Tuesday for the state, and Jim Glasgow will give the rebuttal summation. They get to split theirs, right? And
right.
Joe Lopez brought on, he's known for his summations, his closing arguments, but he's doing it for the defense. So, you know, I think the prosecutors did a good job. This is a really hard case for anyone, and it's under a microscope. It would have been so much harder had there been television cameras, although I wish there had been cameras, because that's a little bit added pressure. But I think they did as well as they could.
I find
a little rusty, maybe a little rusty in some of the trial skills, but they're lovely people who have their hearts in the right place.
I find it interesting that you say you wish that there would have been television cameras. Why?
Well, you know, it's what I do.
Yeah.
But I think that people needed to see this case unfolding. People needed to see the lawyers at work, to see what the jurors were putting up with, and all of these sidebars and the histrionic. It would have made good TV, frankly. But I think people needed to see Illinois justice here. I've never been to trial in Illinois, and I have been covering trials around the United States for 18 years. I mean, I practiced law for 8 years before that, but only in New York State, of course. So this is my first experience in Illinois, and it's been a real eye-opener. It's just a little different for me, and, you know, this is a small community. I think people needed to see Judge Ed Bermilla at work. He is definitely a scholar. He knows the law, and I think he's a good judge, but people needed to see it for themselves and not just rely on what I have to say and any other reporters have to say and the stories that are being written and the tweets. See it for people have a right to see our justice system at work. These are taxpayers paying the salary of everybody in that courtroom except for the defense attorneys, and it's a public courtroom, and the public is lining up every day. 50 people. People are getting up at 4 in the morning, lining up, not as bad as at Casey Anthony, but at least we saw it on television, Casey Anthony. But people are lining up. They're getting up at 3. They're in line at 4 in the morning to get one of the 20, 25 seats for the public in the courtroom. And it's only going to be worse next week because, you know, no more than 20 in the public will probably get into the courtroom. People should be able to sit home and watch this trial. Watch justice at work.
I'm going to ask you to put your, you remember Karnak on Johnny Carson? I'm going to ask you to put your Karnak hat on and guess long deliberation, short deliberation, or hung jury.
I don't know. Let me tell you, one of the rules, but it's not hard and fast, is a day of deliberation for every week of the trial, which would mean like a 5-day deliberation. But I think the jury will start deliberating Tuesday, and we just don't know if the judge is going to let them go into the evening, if he's going to sequester them, or if they'll go home and come back and just work regular work hours. But I do believe that there will be a resolution by next Friday. The jury will start delivering Tuesday afternoon, and we will have a verdict Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday, by Friday.
Beth Karras, senior correspondent, True TV. Thank you. It's been a big kick having you on the show, and I appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
That's Beth Karras from True TV. She's at the Drew Peterson trial. I don't know what's going to happen. The defense talked about nailing Jell-O to a tree. I don't know. Did that nail go through some of the Jell-O, and is it going to stick, or is it going to fall to the ground and wiggle around? Will Drew Peterson be prosecuted for Stacy Peterson? You heard Beth Karras. There's more evidence against Drew Peterson for the disappearance of Stacy. Is that going to happen? It's going to be interesting. Is this case far from being over? I don't think so. I think there's lots more to talk about. That's it. That's tonight's show. I hope you enjoyed it. We are Scared Monkeys Radio at scaredmonkeysradio.com. You can pick up podcasts of past shows, daily commentaries, and listen to the show live, leave comments, and we are here for you. Good night. We'll see you again real soon.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.